Policy Committee for today, Tuesday, January 22nd, 2019. We do have a quorum, and members, we are going to start with the Minnesota Department of Health. They have been working on adverse childhood events, and they'll follow up with CentraCare, who's actually been doing some in-depth work on this. We look forward to hearing from them as well. Let's begin with Ms. Joan Brandt, Children and Family Health Director from the Minnesota Department of Health. Hi, welcome to the committee, and state your name for the record and please proceed. And members, we're going to let her get to the end of her presentation and be prepared with questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity. I'm Joan Brandt. I'm Division Director for Child and Family Health at the State Health Department.
Thank you, Ms. Brandt.
Thank you for the opportunity to talk with you today about ACEs. By way of a little background, the first ACEs study was done in collaboration between Kaiser Permanente and CDC in 1997. The first results were published in 1998. It was really the first study ever to link adverse childhood experiences to health outcomes later in life, and there's been a lot more research since then that we'll talk about in a bit. Over the next few years, CDC allowed states to embed ACEs questions into the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System, or BRFSS. Minnesota did this in their 2011 BRFSS study and released a report dated 2013. You have the executive summary today. My presentation today is built on those findings, along with additional studies that have been done since then, looking at risk, resilience, and ways to best support our families and communities. Over the past 10 years, the information around brain science has really expanded our understanding significantly, particularly as we think about brain development in early childhood. We know from brain science how relationships and experiences prenatally through adolescence can influence our lifelong health and social outcomes. We are built to adapt to our environment, whether it's nurturing or hostile. The environment we live in actually impacts the chemical and structural makeup of our brains, especially as brains develop in early childhood. We know that about 80% of all brain development occurs in early childhood. Not all brain development occurs in early childhood, but about 80% of it actually is developed during those early formative years. So this slide shows that there's adverse societal conditions that build upon adverse childhood experiences and ultimately lead to some health outcomes that are concerning that we're working to address. We know that not all stress is bad. There's normal stress that we all experience on a day-to-day basis. There's acute stress that we learn to, we go through and then we move on from. But then there's also toxic stress. And toxic stress is overwhelming stress that activates our stress response systems and actually creates changes in the brain makeup. We're talking about threats that are severe or prolonged, things like abuse and neglect. Our biological stress response is designed to save our lives from something threatening, and that's healthy. So we develop like a fight or flight response. The problem is that when the stress response is activated repeatedly, it can become overactive and affect our brain development, our immune systems, and even how our DNA is read and transcribed. High doses of stress hormones can inhibit the brain's executive functioning and make it harder for kids or adults to exercise impulse control. So, for example, if we have a family who is living in poverty, is uncertain about their housing for the next month or two, and then you have a child who's living in that situation within the community that is has adverse effects going on, those two kind of work together to make it even worse for the child. So then you put the child in a classroom and expect them to learn using develop their executive function, your prefrontal cortex, and that causes some issues for them. They're more in a fight or flight mode as opposed to a learning and focusing mode. What we know about ACEs is that they're very common. across all populations. More than 55% of all Minnesotans have at least one ACE. Communities are also a source of toxic stress for children and families. Our neighborhoods, workplaces, faith communities, and social policies can all be a source of stress. Things like food insecurity, high rates of unemployment, neighborhood violence, racism, poor access to health services, all impact and create insecurity for families and children. Toxic stress impacts lifelong social and health outcomes and early death if unmitigated. So here you have a triangle that shows kind of the base of those societal conditions that impact the child, and then that disrupts the neurodevelopment and ultimately their ability to develop social and cognitively. And that then has some lifelong consequences in terms of healthy behaviors, as well as just, we know, and some slides coming up will show you that it also has some significant chronic health condition implications. ACE research definitively links toxic stress and trauma in childhood and a wide range of health and social outcomes throughout the lifespan. We know how this happens. The pathway or mechanism, starting with those biological and brain changes, often lead to social, emotional, and cognitive impairment. Social impairment is the mismatch between a person's environment and a brain as it adapts to the toxic stress. When our body, as I mentioned before, our body's producing the high levels of stress hormones, we then go into a danger. There's a danger mode, a fight or flight kind of response, and then it makes it harder for us to pay attention to what's in front of us. There's an undeniable relationship between the social determinants of health and ACEs. They're mutually reinforcing. This triangle encompasses many different actors and sectors of our society. Things like healthcare, advocates, human services, legal, economic development, all of them play a factor in making an impact in the different levels related to toxic stress. So here what we see from the research is that the more sources of toxic stress a person has, the more likely they are to have poor life outcomes. It's the pileup of stress that matters. For example, just considering ACEs, we know that for each additional childhood trauma a person reported, they were more likely to experience poor health as their life goes on. Here you can see that with five or more ACEs, there are 36% of those with five or more ACEs compared to no ACEs experience depression. There's a similar pattern with anxiety. And when we look at a wide range of chronic health conditions such as asthma, diabetes, and obesity, the same thing holds true. Five or more ACEs is a higher risk, you have much higher risk category for developing a chronic health condition. In Minnesota, we also looked at social factors and found that those experiencing these conditions were more likely to have five or more ACEs. So the implications of ACEs include health and social factors. Those with a pileup of stress are more likely to have poor social outcomes. From low education levels, such as you see in the slide here, relationships, unemployment, food insecurity. This put them at greater risk for poor health and trauma and continues the cycle. The connection between community and individual community factors, including the availability of resources and peer support for parents, influences familial and child stress. It's difficult for a parent to engage in the serve and return that we know is so important for brain development if they're worried about their basic needs being met, such as housing or food. If you think about Maslow's hierarchy of needs, food, housing, that's the base. And if a family is at risk of losing or not having those, it's difficult then for the parent to engage in the interaction with the child. It's essential for forming the brain development. As well, if families and communities experience generations of adversity, we have to understand the ramifications of that adversity is not only on the child, but also on the family. We look at things like discrimination and health disparities, and as you can see from this slide, the number of ACEs is significant within the African American and American Indian populations. This leads us, and the evidence shows, that things like historical trauma and racism have impact on the number of ACEs that people experience and their long-term health outcomes. So we talk about historical trauma, things like racism, and epigenetics, which is the study of the interplay between genes and the environment. We know that what has happened in my womb was influenced by what happened in my mom's womb and my grandmother's womb. The same is true that research, particularly out of Scandinavia, shows that the same is true what happened in my grandfather's history. It certainly impacted my father and has impacted my genetic makeup as well. We see that the science of epigenetics is clear about the effect of stress caused by discrimination not only on parents, but also on children. It's the decades-long stress of discrimination and othering that's helped to form some of our most stubborn health disparities. An example, this research specifically is researchers developed a conditioned response to cherry blossoms in mice. Mice continued to exhibit the response two generations later, even though the stimulant wasn't there. It's not all doom and gloom, however. There is hope. Toxic stress can be mitigated, and it's not destiny for individuals or families. We see individual family and community resilience every day. However, it's not an absolute or internal trail. In the face of toxic stress, children and families need opportunities to buffer the stress. They need people around them, supportive relationships, and connectedness. We know that if we intervene early with detection and prevention, that we can make a difference in the development of that child and family. Studies show that when kids received early, high-quality intervention, their brain scans ended up looking more like children who'd never been maltreated than those who were abused. The most important and effective things we can do to promote the resilience and support and strength for children and families include opportunities where they build supportive relationships that are nurturing, that they have a chance to develop social and emotional skills to build their sense of hope and self-efficacy, that they are surrounded by a community or culture or faith that gives them a sense of belonging and gives a sense of meaning and purpose in life, and where they can meaningfully contribute, as well as improving conditions within the community that promote relationships, hope, reduce stressors, create spaces where families can feel safe and be outdoors. We also know that economic opportunities and equitable policies help families prevent or mitigate the impact of toxic stress. Things that we're doing in the state all to mitigate the societal conditions as well as the childhood and family experiences are family home visiting. We know is one of the most effective ways because it's working with a two-generation approach and provides families with connections to resources to address some of the societal conditions, as well as working with the parent and the child in terms of that brain development, the serve and return that's so important for healthy development. We also have a state community health services advisory subgroup that's working on the role of counties in children of incarcerated parents work group, which we know is one of the number one and highest risk ACEs specifically within Minnesota. It's the most common ACE among youth in Minnesota. And it's the focus of the group is really looking at what's the role that the county can play in mitigating factors, because these children are often invisible. Folks don't know that their parents, children don't reveal necessarily that their parents are incarcerated. We also have a mental well-being and resilience learning community, which is a monthly gathering of about 37 sites across the state to discuss strategies specific to build on their communities. They share what's working well in their community with other communities, and it's a really vibrant learning community that has done a lot of work around what are good things to do within your community that support families. That's it. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. Any questions?
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Brand, for this. This is really good information. I have a couple questions, but first I just want to tell a brief story that the community that we raised our children in is Fairmont. and it was one of the first pilot projects for early childhood family education years ago. And I always say they helped me raise my children. Back in 02, I was elected, and I remember in 03, the community, along with law enforcement and the county and the city, pulled together enough money to fly in Robin Carr Morse, who is the author of Ghost in the Nursery. Mm-hmm. And it was a three-day seminar at the Fairmont Opera House, and they invited law enforcement, teachers, daycare providers, the medical community, anybody who was touching children along the way. The place was packed for 3 days, and I went, and I couldn't believe the information, exactly what we now know. But this was back in 03 they did this, and this was community-driven. It wasn't mandated from the state. It wasn't, they just did it on their own. A bunch of people got together, and it was basically the police chief who brought this group together. And so I just want to leave that impression that most of this work needs to be at a community
level.
So in your slide on page 10, the framework for community action couldn't be more appropriate, that it comes organically from the bottom up to deal with these issues. And since then, they have the youth prevention programs, they have the statewide, youth drug prevention programs, they have a lot of programs that they are very well driven from that community. And they share their resources around the area. And that's why I guess I have been a proponent of SHIP too, because they have been able to use that resource in a very well manner throughout the various counties. And sometimes it doesn't always work like that throughout the state, but SHIP has been excellent for that area. I'm interested in getting your information on the state community health group, some data, why recreate the wheel if we could somehow share information coming out of that group, and also the mental well-being strategies work group.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And if you can give us more information on that, because we are obviously working on mental health. That's Senate File 1, is mental health, and it is touching everybody in this room. It's the number one issue at the county level now. It used to be roads and bridges. You go to any county commissioner and they say, please help us with our mental health issues. Mm-hmm. So we need to create an environment where we can share these resources and we can start thinking out of the box. If you could help us with that'd be great.
Ms. Brandt?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, we're happy to share. There will be a report at the end of the Community Health Services Advisory Committee work group on the incarceration, and we'd be happy to share that, absolutely. Anna can certainly, we can send more information to you about the community, the learning communities as well, certainly.
Senator Rosen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is that going to be in time for us to do our pre-work here and get some bills introduced? Ms. Brandt?
Great. Senator, members of the committee, we'll do our best, absolutely.
Thank you. Members, other questions for Ms. Brandt? Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Chair Benson. I just wanted to thank you for this presentation and the fact that the Minnesota Department of Health is very involved in the ACEs and bringing that to us as legislators and throughout the state. I was part of a program with Dr. Robert Anda and discussing ACEs a few years ago, and it's truly life-changing for us to begin to realize the importance of these very early years and how this toxic stress can build and last well into adulthood. And so I thank you, Chair, for focusing on this. I think it's one of the key, as educators, we know that prevention is worth a pound of cure. And this is prevention. And so I just thank you for bringing this today and the Chair for allowing time for this important discussion.
Thank you, Senator Nelson and Ms. Brandt. We're going to step to our next presenters. The Adverse Childhood Events is presented by CentraCare, and Mr. Santo Cruz, Ms. Jody Gertkin and Dr. Jerry Jacobson. And if I mispronounced anyone's names, please, as you state them for the record, I will update my phonetics. Welcome.
Chair Benson, you're 3 for 3. That is how you say our names. So, Chair Benson and members, my name is Santo Cruz on behalf of CentraCare Health. I'm really excited about being here today, not because we're here to talk about some victory lap that CentraCare is taking in the world of ACEs, but it's a little bit of a sharing with you some of the steps on a journey that not just CentraCare, but many health systems around the state and certainly around the country and providers in general are going through, and that's a transition that many of you are well aware of. That's a journey from volume to value, from prescriptions to prevention, and from auditing service lines to listening to your local community. As Senator Rosen correctly said, much of our work in this space has grown organically from conversations and listening to our local community. What you'll hear today is a little bit of a preview of some work that CentraCare has been involved in with Twin Cities Public Television for the past 3 years, creating a docu-series that's currently leading up to this Sunday, episode 3 of 5 on ACEs. What you'll see in that program, and if you go online and go up to episode 1 and 2, which if the technology cooperates, we'll see a minute of here later on. What you'll see is not CentraCare holding itself out as the only model of doing this, but actually many community members who've come forward, both from the county attorney's office, the local police chief, the county human services office, talking about how to approach this this issue as whole people. And that's the name of the first episode, is addressing patients as whole persons. So I thank you for the opportunity to talk about some of that work today. Then you'll hear from Dr. Jerry Jacobson. She is the chief medical officer and a pediatrician at CentraCare, who runs our Child Advocacy Center. There are two hospital-based child advocacy centers in the state of Minnesota. One is at the Mayo Clinic in Senator Nelson's district, and the other is up in St. Cloud. And Dr. Will share with you a little bit about what that work looks like and what trauma-informed care in terms of learning from ACEs and actually implementing it for the good of patients, what that looks like. So with that, I would turn it over to Jody Gertkin.
Thank you, Santo. Excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. As Santo mentioned, my name is Jody Gertkin, and I've been with CentraCare since 2004, and I'm currently the Community Wellness Program Director. So since 2004, CentraCare Health has been changing the way that our communities think about health and leading very successful efforts to improve health outcomes throughout central Minnesota, first with a focus on reducing tobacco's harm and increasing smoke-free workplaces, which helped lead the state to become a smoke-free state in 2007, to reducing childhood obesity in the greater St. Cloud area by 24% when the rest of the state and nation were facing epidemic rates for the first time. Most recently, we've added a specific focus on the awareness and prevention of ACEs. As you just learned, children who experience traumatic events, their health is significantly impacted, and they're at much greater risk of developing chronic diseases, including some forms of cancer. Recognizing the importance and urgency of addressing these serious community health issues, CentraCare Health recently launched what we call Feeling Good Minnesota. It's an initiative that works with partner organizations from all sectors of our community to improve health by advancing changes in policies, systems, and environments. We understand an estimated 80% of what drives health outcomes does not happen within our hospitals and clinic settings. Therefore, we are focusing on practical and innovative ways to positively impact the health of our residents today and for generations to come. We are creating healthier communities by authentically engaging whole communities to make healthy options automatic, affordable, and accessible to everyone. With a focus on prevention, health equity, and collaboration, Feeling Good Minnesota will help lower chronic disease rates, reduce healthcare costs, and ultimately attract people to live and work in our communities. Our main focus areas include encouraging and supporting active lifestyles through the development of sidewalks, bike lanes, and other modes of active transportation that make it easy and safe for people to be physically active.
We are also improving and promoting the affordability, availability, and accessibility of healthy foods in schools, workplaces, and communities. We're advocating for and supporting the implementation of enhanced policies that will reduce and restrict smoking tobacco, tobacco, and e-cigarette use. And we're providing education to the community about the long and short-term health effects of adverse childhood experiences. We are identifying tools and resources needed to address and prevent ACEs from having devastating effects in our communities. Which is why, as Santo just mentioned, we have entered into a partnership with Twin Cities Public Television on the creation of the documentaries titled Whole People. This series began airing on June 13th, and as mentioned, will continue to run every Sunday at 7 p.m. through February 17th. All of the episodes once aired can be viewed on our website at feelinggoodmn.org. These videos tell the local story of how trauma affects individuals and generations, and what we are leading in central Minnesota to combat this cycle and inform others about the long-term effects of trauma and ACEs. I believe now you will watch a short video.
We have all been very effectively taught as children that there are certain things that nice people don't talk about and surely don't ask.
What happens at home stays at home. Well, guess what? That is impossible to do because you carry it with you no matter what.
Children who had adverse childhood experiences, it could be abuse, it could be neglect, it could be anything with regard to that was detrimental to the child without a buffer. What we see now is there's a whole body of research now that's starting to come out, and it's one of the first times that adverse childhood experiences was connected to dying earlier.
The ACE study itself, we had roughly 17,500 people in the study, and we have thus far been following them forward 19 years in time. A very clearly middle-class group. One conclusion is, my God, if things are this bad in a clearly middle-class group, you know, they surely are not going to get better if you're living on the street or in prison or part of an oppressed minority.
We know that by doing therapy or dealing with some of the issues that cause some of that stress, that you can change that and limit the amount of damage that it does to the body.
The health-related cost for an individual versus a system are profound. And that's just pure cost. That's the cost right then. That's not the cost of a child experiencing those adverse events and the clinical outcome that we know will play a role for that child's health.
When you recognize the statistics about how those adverse childhood experiences show up in some of the healthcare issues that we work with and deal with, you recognize pretty quickly that there's work for us to do here in healthcare.
With that, I would turn things over to Madam Chair and members, Dr. Jerry Jacobson.
Welcome, Dr. Jacobson. Please proceed.
Chair Benson and members, thank you for allowing me to talk to you today. So as Carlos mentioned, I'm Dr. Jacobson. I'm a pediatrician, and then I also work in our Child Advocacy Center at CentraCare. And so we know that ACEs exist, and we know that ACEs cost the healthcare system lots of money. But we also know that individuals who have suffered ACEs will thrive if they are provided with safe, stable relationships and environments. We can lessen the impact of ACEs, and we can actually prevent ACEs if we concentrate on that. So trauma-informed care is an idea that when somebody presents for medical care, that we treat the whole person, not just the physical ailment that they're presenting with, but the whole person. So we want them to feel safe physically, but also emotionally, culturally. So I'll give you an example. Before the Child Advocacy Center, if a child disclosed that they had been abused at home to their teacher, the teacher would have that child tell their story again, maybe to the school social worker, and then maybe to the county social worker, and then maybe to the doctor, and then they might go to the police department where they would have a forensic interview amongst that chaos. And so you can imagine that the child had experienced trauma, but then this whole experience was re-traumatizing them. They may feel like people weren't listening to them because they had to tell their story over and over again. So in 2016, CentraCare, along with the community, opened a child advocacy center. And so I'll tell you what happens now when a child discloses abuse. So let's take, so Sarah is a second grader, and she discloses to her teacher at school that her stepfather has touched her inappropriately. The teacher would then contact CPS, Child Protective Services, and then Child Protective Services would contact the other investigative members that need to be a part of this. So they would contact the police, they could contact the Child Advocacy Center, they would contact the county attorney, and then we would all meet the child at this Child Advocacy Center, which is a physical place where the child comes. It is a child-friendly environment. It's safe and quiet. The child would be interviewed there at the center by a forensic interviewer who's trained in talking to children about things that have happened to them. So, you know, Sarah would get this forensic interview done, and then after she's done with her interview, then I could offer a medical exam. And so on this day, Sarah did get a medical exam. I was able to reassure her that the abuse was not her fault. I was able to reassure her and she and her mother that her physical exam was normal. So in terms of there wouldn't be any lasting physical effects of the abuse. I was also able to offer them a mental health referral. And then we know that her best chance of healing is if she has a supportive caregiver. And so we feel like it's our job to then support the caregiver so the caregiver can support the child. So we have an advocate who meets with the family, talks about resources that are available in the community, and then in this case actually helped mom find mental services for herself. So we'll have to wait and see if this will impact Sarah's health outcome positively. I suspect that it will. We know that it did have a positive influence on her and her mother because they left the Child Advocacy Center with smiles. We also got a survey a couple days later where mom expressed that she was very thankful for the Child Advocacy Center, thanked us for the care that they received, and said that this was the best experience on the worst day of their lives. Thank you.
Members, we've had pretty serious introduction to the work that's being done at CentraCare. Do you have questions for them? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Jacobson, several of us on this committee serve on the Child Protection Task Force. Is there any statutes at this time that cause you problems or something that we need to work on? We have actually 93 recommendations, and we're slowly clicking them off, but we have a lot of work in that task force. But is there anything that really stands out that we need to address?
Dr. Jacobson?
If you think of it later,
yeah,
you can certainly
I
come up.
I can't think of anything off the top of my head.
Okay. Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question I have for you is, from what you see from this, it's rather a long term. You're not going to really know. I mean, you have that immediate feedback, which is so crucial, so very, very important for them. But also to follow along a little bit, to see what happens in the next month, 6 months, a year, two or three. So do you have things that you're doing to help kind of track and see, do they need to continue? What's the follow-up after that?
Right. So we are tracking. Oh, excuse me.
That's all right.
Chair Benson and members. We are tracking the children that we see, and the sort of things that we're tracking are, did we refer for mental health services? Did the child present for mental health services? The National Children's Alliance also looks at that data because what we'd like to know is fairly soon we'll know if that child is exhibiting symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, and so that's something that will be measurable fairly soon. And then there are all those other long-term sort of effects that we can look at down the road.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The other thing is that because of what you are doing uniquely so, there was some legislation a while ago on helping very young children to know better. In other words, what is a safe touch, what is a not good touch? You know, there are, you don't want to introduce for young children fear or concepts that they are too young for. But do you see a pattern when you're working with these children that you kind of think about what could they have been educated on or talked about earlier that would maybe help them to avoid those kinds of situations, if possible?
Madam Chair.
Dr. Jacobson.
Madam Chair and members. So I actually feel pretty strongly about that. I think that there should be a curriculum within the schools that talks about body safety, and so we're working on that right now. There's something, the program is called Safe and Strong, and it just talks to kids about helping them identify adults in their life that they could talk to if they were having any concerns at home, if there were any issues, if they were confused about something, but identifying somebody other than their parents, because 90% of the time the abuse is coming at the hands of someone that they know, and so helping them identify a teacher that they could trust or other adults like that. And so we're working on getting into the schools because we feel like that would be very important.
Thank you, Madam
Chair. Senator Kiffmeyer.
And I think probably the biggest thing in reading a little bit and talking about this, that there are extended family, and so often, you know, the poor moms and dads take the brunt of the suspicion, when lots of times they are unknowing as well, and how to handle that. But also it can be, as we saw the most, the big one that came, it was a coach. For young women in a gymnastics situation. I mean, it's amazing where these sorts of things, and that there's usually among some sort of trusted relationship, and that's the hardest thing. We always think of the stranger one, but it isn't. But I think I would just be careful about, even if it is that too often parents come under a lot of stress and scrutiny themselves, and that we not make misguided conclusions that can actually be harmful to the very people who are often one of the greatest advocates for their children.
And Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't want to go too far afield here, but I think I have some experts in front of me that might just be able to answer a question that I have. And so the brain science is really clear about toxic stress, and that's the developing brain. But I'm just curious, are you aware of any either brain science or how to, you know, toxic stress affects adults too? And I'm just curious on the, if there is that body of work on how toxic stress affects adults, and is it the same type of things that we'd be looking at, safe, stable relationships and environment. I realize it's a little off the ACEs, but Madam Chair, if you could just grant me just a little bit of time to hear what do we know about toxic stress and adults? And I'm particularly thinking how it might impact our mental health issues and our increase in mental health needs.
And Dr. Jacobson, would you like to attempt an answer?
Madam Chair. So I'll be honest, I don't know a lot about the research that's being done on adults, but we know that the developing brain is particularly susceptible to toxic
yes.
stress. But we also know that the brain isn't fully developed for maybe till you're in your 20s, and there certainly can be some... I'll just say that. The brain isn't fully developed until you're about 20 or so. And so, but obviously, I mean, chronic stress isn't good for adults either, but I don't know anything about the research.
Thank you.
Sorry.
Thank you. Thank you all very much. Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Jacobson, thank you for your presentation. Two questions. One is, could you just elaborate a little bit more on in some of these ACE studies, just terms what constitutes the emotional abuse component in terms of it, the criteria being met? And then secondly, is are there any kind of longitudinal studies where we try to go back in time and look at number of ACEs for perhaps the 1940s, the 1960s, the 1980s? I mean, just to sort of give us a handle, because you know clearly it seems like we have a much, much greater mental illness in the population from 0 to 18, probably at every level. But I was just wondering if we've been able to do retrospective interviews and things like that and try to determine where's this all coming from and what exactly is happening, because maybe if we knew what was happening in a trend kind of fashion, maybe we'd know what we might do going forward. So two questions. One, elaborate a bit more on the definition of emotional abuse. And two, are there any studies that would help us look back in time so that we might be able to go forward in time? Thank you.
Dr. Jacobson.
Madam Chair. So in terms of the emotional abuse, I know on the so the ACE questionnaire that they were using in Dr. Folletti's study that was the original study said things like, do people in your home make you feel bad about yourself? Are they, you know, saying, I don't know exactly what it was, but every day saying things that make you feel bad about yourself or calling you names, things like that. And so, and then I don't know about any longitudinal studies. I mean, honestly, so I was working as a pediatrician and then I started working in the Child Advocacy Center, and I've just gotten into the, I mean, I've been doing trauma-informed care probably a lot longer than the last couple of years, but I haven't gone much into the research yet.
Thank you. And Mr. Cruz, I'll give you the last word, but I'd like a reminder for the benefit of the committee where they can find the PBS special.
Madam Chair and members, thank you so much for the opportunity. Certainly, we invite you to tune in to Twin Cities Public Television at 7:30?
7 p.m.
7 p.m. on Twin Cities Public Television, the Minnesota channel, which is statewide. What I would say in terms of wrapping up is just a reiteration of where I started, that this is not Centricare or any one health system taking a victory lap. This is sharing some steps that we need to do much more work on, much more implementation of, much more tracking and research. But that shouldn't prevent us from trying things. At Centricare, we have primary care in the jails. We are doing a number of different innovative things that are out of the box without the benefit of there being a replicable study on it, because we're listening to our local community and providing care at the highest level and as locally as we can for our folks. So I just want to say thank you for this opportunity, and you're more than welcome to invite us back for any of these topics. We're always happy to come and talk with you all.
Thank you all for joining us today. And members, I hope if you get some time, watch the PBS show, I guess it would be called, docuseries, there we go, on adverse childhood experiences. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Now, Senator Ralph, as some of us have heard, Senate File 74 in another committee. All of us have heard the contents of Senate File 74 last session. And Senator Ralph, welcome to the committee. And it looks like Senator Abler is a co-author. Senator Abler?
I'd like to move the bill.
Senator Abler moves Senate File 74. Senator Ralph, please proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Basically, as was mentioned, this is all language that we looked at last year and kind of got wrapped up in the omnibus bill and didn't get through. What we're going to focus on today is just the things that affect the Department of Health in the bill. The bill is a much broader, I would say, reform of many of the things in human services, but we'll focus today on just the Department of Health, which is primarily Articles 1 and 2, I believe Article 4, and that's about it. My understanding is that this bill will then go back to human services So we're not going to present any amendments. We do have a couple of things to take out, one of them being the homeless youth study, because the department has actually completed a different study. So we felt that there's no reason to update the 2007. With that, I would like to turn it over to Senate Council, and they can walk you through the bill. It's, in many cases, fairly technical, and I think they're much better prepared to present this than I am.
Madam Chair and members, Kavanaugh? I'll start with Article 1 is one section, and that has to do with the Health Services Policy Committee evaluating and making recommendations on the integration of non-pharmacological pain management that are clinically viable and sustainable, and then reporting back to the legislature on a possible pilot program to assess this.
Madam Chair, members, I will cover Articles 2 and 4. So Article 2 contains language related to home care licensing. This was language that was worked out between provider groups and the department last session. Primarily, its purpose was to clarify and refine the licensing standards. It deals with modifying the definition of standby assistance. I'm just going to hit some of the highlights here. It deals with what happens when there's a change of ownership in a home care provider. It deals with procedures surrounding temporary licenses, and in particular, imposes a new $1,000 fine on a home care provider with a temporary license who fails to notify the commissioner within 5 days that the provider has begun to actually provide services to clients. The language also clarifies what happens when a license is suspended, when a license is issued with conditions, when a license is revoked. There's quite a bit of language surrounding the storage and management of medications, particularly controlled substances. And then there's a lot of language surrounding policies and procedures related to infection control. And that's the highlights of the article. And Article 4, Article 4 amends the predatory offender registration statute to require that a predatory offender provide notice to a licensed home care provider in the same manner that a health care facility receives notice. So under current law, if you're a resident of, for example, a nursing home, you have to inform the nursing home that you're on the predatory offender registration list. There's no provision for home care providers, so the language inserts a similar provision for home care providers.
Members, any questions? Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I can see the bill summary online here, but it's not in our packets, or at least it's not in my packet. Did everyone get a copy of the bill summary? Okay, I just need one. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. If it's available online, we'll have it sent out so members are apprised. But members, any further questions?
Madam Chair.
And I have Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Ralph, just looking at Article 1, Section 1, the pain management section, and just wondering the collaboration on this. I believe that non-pharmacological pain management is absolutely an area that needs attention. I just find it interesting that the Health Services Policy Committee shall evaluate and make recommendations on the integration of that type of pain management. That just seems a little ass backwards. Sorry.
Senator Ralph?
How do I answer that?
Okay, so no questions from Senator Rosen. If I could counsel, as we're moving language that we represent to the committee as having been passed last year, could you walk us through the drafting process and help us understand what might have been included, excluded? I know Senator Ralph has an amendment to this language that's going to happen in another committee, and I would ask that he give assurances that he won't amend our language. So if council could help us understand the drafting process.
Madam Chair, members, the nonpartisan staff in our office was given direction by a member to pull together the language from last year's omnibus bill that fell within the jurisdiction of Senator Abler's committee, or for which Senator Abler had taken the lead in moving through the legislative process. That's what ended up in this bill. We did run a computer comparison of this bill to last year's omnibus bill, and we can assure you that, except for one cross-reference that I added and some technical tweaks that the reviser performed before jacketing this version, and we updated dates, effective dates, internal dates related to reports and so forth. Except for those exceptions, the language is identical to what was in the omnibus bill last year.
Thank you. Members, questions to that point? Senator Jensen.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, it's not to that point.
Okay. And Mr. Albrecht, if you could talk to us about fiscal impact in this bill to this committee's jurisdiction. Are we going to need to have a fiscal note for this committee's benefit for this language, in your opinion?
Madam Chair and members, I guess that would depend on your preference. There is one provision in Article 6. It's Section 7. And which is on page 69, line 69.6, deals with the changes on line 70.24, allowing a hearing in instances where the county disputes the cost of care in a state-operated facility. It's my understanding that this language did have fiscal notes attributed to it last year, so I would expect it to this year. The money for that fiscal note would be in the OIG's office, which is in this committee's jurisdiction.
Okay. Members, I just wanted you to be aware of that. Senator Ralph, I'm not trying to hang up your bill. Senator Abler, comments to that?
Thanks,
point?
And I couldn't hear it very well, Madam Chair. So it was our intention that this would be a non-fiscal, non-controversial bill. Is there a fiscal impact to this section, or is it not a state fiscal impact?
Senator Abler, yes, there was. There were fiscal notes completed for this language last year.
And that showed a cost of some sort.
Madam Chair, Senator Abler, yes.
Yeah.
Right. Well, Madam Chair, this is going to go back to our committee, and if there's cost, this is not meant to be a fiscal bill, so we'll clean that up.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Abler. Senator Ralph, I'd like your assurance that we'll have Mr. Albrecht review and advise on any fiscal impact. Mm-hmm.
I believe what we're talking about is the county, is the provision that allows counties to notify if they've notified that there's a plan available for a person in a state mental facility, and somehow it gets administratively delayed, and that person stays in the facility when they actually should be discharged into a county program, that the county can seek compensation for that. And I understand that there might be a fiscal impact to that, and I think we have to look at that. So,
okay. And members, this does have to go to Senator Abler's committee. That'll be its next stop. And to judiciary, and I'll check in with Senator Ralph to make sure that these provisions are amended out so it doesn't have a fiscal impact on our budget without your awareness. Okay. Anything further to that point? And I know Senator Jensen has something before we leave. Senator Abler.
Just to the whole bill, there is the department has had a significant amount of pretty minor technical advice, it seems, and a couple small decision points that we'll take up in the other committee, which I think are not going to be controversial, but they might be interesting to people who are caring about the language, so they're going to want to check out the amendment that we'll post, which is going to be put together in association with the department, and we would be taking testimony if people had any questions about that. But further, the more significant change is in Article 6, I think it is, with the team challenge language allowing the set-aside. We've been told that the language in the bill really didn't accomplish what we would like, and I'm under the idea that this was supposed to be last year's stuff going forward, the intent of an improved piece of language would be still fit under that umbrella, although somewhat strained. And so I'm taking under advisement if that language should come back from the House when they bring it to us, or if we should send that to them. And so we may or may not act on that section when we do this again, just so people know who care about that. It's a very important section. We have alcohol drug counselors and staff who can't work, who worked really great last week, but now they changed addresses and at their employer and can't work. So thank you.
Thank you, Senator Abler. Senator Jensen, thank you for your patience.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to take a moment to say thank you to Liam Monahan and Senator Ralph for tackling some of these tough bills. I mean, these are not easy, and they're 75 pages, and you go through them and you prepare them. And I just know that oftentimes, Senator Ralph, you've been willing to take these bills on and help elucidate them for us, and I thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, members. Anything further? Okay, then Senator Abler moves that Senate File 74 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Human Services Reform, Policy, and Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you. Senator Ralph, your bill is passed. And members, we will meet again on Thursday. I thank you for your attention to these challenging topics, and we are adjourned.